Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
So we jump in the car. Well, it turns out that the EMP car and driver they were going to use for the undercover to carry us broke down on the way there. So this just happens to be Joe Schmo, a taxi driver, dressed with the same attire that everybody tells us. As we leave the airport, we're going up this little bit of an incline, and the car stalls. Then all of a sudden, these three guys approach the car, and they're trying to push the car. I open the car door to get out, and she's pulled me back in the car, like, you don't want me to leave, because she knows what's going to happen. If these are the bad guys, they're going to take me. I don't have any plans for the plane. First of all, and second of all, I'm a DEA agent. You know what that's a DEA agent's life is like down there in the Colombian Ecuador. Yep. So I get out of the car eventually and start pushing the car. So now I've got four of us pushing the car. We jump start the car. Off we go again. I jump back in the car and running, going down the highway. Everything's going good. And it seems like we're in the mountains. Remember that movie, You're in Present Danger?
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to part two of our interview on Game of Crimes with Murph in the Morning. Our guest this week is Sam Trotman. He was a criminal investigator for 5 years with the Camden County, New Jersey Prosecutor's Office. And then he was with DEA for, I didn't tell everybody how long were you a DEA agent?
25 years.
25 years. So got some unbelievable stories. And, you know, the folks I brought in here before from New York, they always have the funniest stories. But we're talking about a guy named LaKika, or the street name was LaKika. His real name is Danny Munoz Mosquera. He's the man who was responsible for putting the bomb on the Avianca flight back in 1989 that blew up on a flight between Bogota and Cali that killed 107 innocent people plus 3 people on the ground. I was reading a little bit about that plane crash, and the debris was spread over 3 miles. So just 3 people just... I mean, man, you talk about bad luck. Yeah. Just your time to go when something like that happens.
That was bad.
But Sam had told us yesterday about the arrest of LaKika and going through the trial. One thing I forgot to mention was his first trial for lying to a federal agent. What happened on that first one?
Oh, the first one, he was convicted for lying to a federal agent.
No, the first one, he had a mistrial, didn't he?
No, that was the first trial for the drug charges and the conspiracy and the CCE and the RICO. So what happened was the first trial was the lying to a federal agent, mm-hmm. basically anywhere from 0 to 6 months. We did the hearing, first sentencing hearing, and we got him 6 years. In the interim, we still continued on with the investigation, and we had him indicted for, there was four superseding indictments before we went to trial. I think the third one was when we went to the first trial, and that wound up to being a hung jury. There was 11 jurors that voted guilty, and one would not deliberate, so we were told. Mm-hmm. That turned out, it was very obvious during the trial, but that was racially motivated mm-hmm. for sure. Whenever it was myself and two white female prosecutors that were presenting the case for the government. And then on the defense side, there was a Hispanic woman. I think she was the interpreter, but she might've been a paralegal for the defense as well. And then there was two black defense attorneys. And of course, a Colombian male, dark skinned Colombian male. And whenever the government got up to present its case, the one juror would always turn her back to the government. It was very blatant. And then whenever the defense got up to question, she would turn around and face the defense attorneys.
You're kidding.
It was so obvious that we even presented it to the judge, and the judge said, oh, we'll just continue on going through with it. We'll see what happens at the end. Well, at the end, we got a chance to meet with the jurors, interview 11 out of the 12 of them. No, nothing to say more about that. And they all voted conviction for everything. But because the juror would not deliberate.
Was the judge Sterling Johnson?
It was.
I'm surprised he was pretty no-nonsense judge.
He was a no-nonsense judge. Yeah. He was.
I'm surprised he didn't tell the juror to turn around and pay attention.
Well, I don't know what the basis of that was, but it was so blatant. It was like if you were in the courtroom, you could see it. You know, blind man could see it. That's how blatant it was.
Jeez.
So wound up going, it was about 3 months of trial. I think we had over 50 witnesses.
Oh.
And then come up with a hung jury. So then we reindicted the case, make it simpler, mm-hmm. put for the jury, and started the trial again. And then went up to trial for another 3 months, and then ultimately found them guilty on all counts.
Man. What a pain.
So lived that twice.
You can laugh about it now, but it certainly wasn't funny back then, was it?
Oh, no, it was not funny then, because all the amount of, you know, I was eating, sleeping, and dreaming this case. And, you know, the amount of work that went involved, the logistics, even when he was in the MDC in New York, he made plans to try and escape in New York.
Really?
So that was another one of the charges that were involved, or the acts involved with the crimes that were charged. I was meeting with the prior to the trial, I was meeting with the marshals. There were threats against the prosecutors, so we had put agents on providing security for them as well. And then whenever they moved Mascara from the MDC over to Brooklyn to the courthouse, they would shut down the Brooklyn Bridge. NYPD would shut down the Brooklyn Bridge.
Wow.
There was even information we received that they were going to try and bust Lakika out during the transport. So ram the marshal's vehicle and the transport vehicle and then break him out of the transport vehicle. So they wound up shutting the Brooklyn Bridge down, had snipers up on the roofs. It was, really, if you want to look at it, it was a real show, but it was good. I mean, we did what we had to do, and security was at the highest.
You talk about ticking a lot of New Yorkers off, though, shutting down the bridge.
Yeah. So, lights and siren across the bridge into the courthouse, and then have to take them back, you know, each day for courts.
Jeez. And those cases are few and far between of that level of security, aren't they?
Yeah.
I don't know if it's like that now. I would assume it still is, but with all the Mexican traffickers coming up, but holy cow.
Yeah, it was crazy.
I remember when we came up for that first hearing, we all ended up at one of the prosecutor's apartments to watch the World Cup was playing. I don't know. Did you come over that night? I don't know if we were at Beth's or Cheryl's apartment and was Colombia playing the United States.
No, I wasn't there.
And that was the game where the Colombian player accidentally scored against his own team.
I did hear about that. Yeah.
And the Colombian cops were with us, and they're like, and when they saw it, we're giving them a hard time. We're busting each other's chops big time. And they said, "You see that guy? That's a dead man right there.
Dead man walking right there."
They're serious about their soccer. Crazy stuff. Now, did Lakika, when he was sentenced to, was it two life terms? Is that right?
He was initially sentenced to 10 life sentences.
10.
And then I remember the defense attorneys, they filed an appeal, and they won the appeal, and basically he got one life sentence. They're saying you can't do 10 life sentences. You're either doing life or you're not doing life, but you do it 10 times. So they wound up winning the appeal, and he was sentenced to life. And then when the marshals provided me some photographs when they got transported, they flew him out on a Black Hawk helicopter and did a midair refueling, never landed. It was crazy. There was so much hype about the Medellin cartel trying to break him out at any given point. So they didn't want to take any chances, and they flew him by Black Hawk out to Colorado prison.
Oh, we talked about some Supermax.
The Supermax out in Colorado, and in the meantime, they were doing their midair refueling. Got him into Colorado, and he served there for quite some time until I guess a lot of this has kind of blown over and subsided quite a bit. Now, I'm not sure where he's at now, but I don't think he's in Colorado anymore.
Has he ever talked that you know of to anybody?
Not that I'm aware of.
Yeah, I'm not either. I've heard that he's never talked to anybody. No. At his trial, did any of his family come up?
I don't think so. So I don't think anybody from the family came up. But I think there wasn't. I don't know if that was from the first trial. It might be from the first trial somebody had come up. But I think he's got. I think he's got a sister or something here living in the United States. I think.
Yeah, it's been so long ago. Yeah, I don't remember.
I think there was somebody I don't know if it was an aunt, uncle, or I don't think it was the mother. And it definitely wasn't any of their brothers. But you I think there was somebody that showed up at the, may have been the first trial.
After he was convicted, you probably already know this, but the Attorney General of Colombia wrote a letter to the United States, to the Attorney General of the United States, saying that Laquica was innocent.
Yeah, that happened. I think happened right before the second trial.
Gustavo de Grief.
Well, Gustavo was dirty.
Mm-hmm.
And had I had stayed in New York longer than I did, there was a good chance that we were bringing charges against him. And I forget the lady's name. There was a female prosecutor.
Cruz Elena?
Yes. We were prepared to bring charges against both of them.
I think Cruz Elena lives here in the United States now.
Oh, does she?
I think so. I think Javier told me that.
Well, I still have some documentation for that one. Swear me in, boys.
Well, and the significance of Gustavo de Grief, he was the Attorney General of Colombia. He's the one that created that self-surrender program that led to Pablo surrendering into his custom-built prison.
Correct.
But yep. He's also the one that authorized Pablo to build his own prison, which was a joke.
And then turn around and trying to provide us with all the documentation to prove him guilty. And we're talking about Laquica being guilty. And then turn around and say, I got evidence that he's not, he's innocent.
Yeah.
But that's, we also have evidence that Gustavo was in the pockets of both Medellin and Cali cartel personnel. Mm. Yeah.
Well, I think he's deceased now.
Yeah, I think he's done. So no need to pursue it any further.
Yeah. I would have liked to see him go to prison because he was a very intelligent man, but he was just playing it. He was beating everybody like a drum.
Right.
It was terrible. Well, so I'll have to look up and see where Laquica is. I don't know where he is now.
Yeah, I don't
know
where he's at now. I don't think he's in Colorado any longer. I think they downgraded him.
Yeah, and it's been, so he was, I think he was 26 when he was arrested. So he's probably in his, 50s or 60s now?
Right.
Probably in his 50s.
It's been, 30 years now. So he's 55, 56, if he was 26.
Yeah, something
like that.
It's
been over 30 years now, so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that was an extremely significant case because of who he represented, the horrendous acts of violence that he committed. Just, they thought, and the theory behind him putting that bomb on the plane was that Cesar Gaviria, who was running for president after they killed Galan, was going to be on that plane to go up to talk to people in Cali. And at the last minute, he changed his travel plans. It's the only reason he wasn't on that plane.
Right.
But that the level of violence that these guys were willing to go to kill all those innocent people just to try to get to one person who ended up not even being on the plane.
Yeah. And then we had also reports of there was informants on that plane. So again, it didn't make any difference because it was the Medellin cartels are what orchestrated it. They carried it out. And anybody that was involved with the Medellin cartel is guilty on that. So that's why I said there was one person.
There were supposed to be two DEA agents on that plane that day going to Cali to talk to the cops about other cases. And for whatever reason, the priorities changed in the embassy for the day and they didn't make the trip. Not that they had any information about a bomb. It's just, grace of God that they did not get on that plane that day.
Right.
Jeez.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, there's the story of Dandini Munoz Mosquera, if you ever wondered what that was. But in our exchanges here, you told me about an undercover that you did while you were in New York, still rookie agent, where you had to go to a foreign country. And tell us a little bit about that. What's that all about?
So that was I got to New York in February 1991. We did the buy bus story we told about. That was in March, April. So in May, there was three guys that had been arrested by DEA, and they were charged with conspiracy to import controlled substances into the United States. There were three of them that had escaped from the MDC in New York. And one of them got caught fairly quickly. Another one got caught, shortly thereafter. And this guy, Herman Velez, had escaped and made his way back to Colombia with the contacts with the informants and whatnot. They were able to get him on the phone and make arrangements to make plans to get receipts for a diagram of an airplane on how to smuggle cocaine back to the United States. And the ultimate plan was that I would fly down there as the informant's son with my stepmother, who was a Colombian female. I was probably about 30 years old at the time. And so she was 30. So it was my stepmother. And you know, there's women down in Colombia. You know, they're just some good looking women down there, but still not the better ones are in the United States.
There you go. There you go.
There are some good looking women down there. So she was a good looking woman. And we made arrangements to fly from down to Quito, Ecuador. And he was going to come over, cross the border from Colombia to Ecuador, meet us. And we were going to give him plans, like I said, to how to smuggle coke on an airplane, a location they could put it. And I would stay there with the family, the Colombian family, as a hostage to guarantee that the flight would get in and the cocaine would safely arrive. That was kind of the orchestrated plan. Mm-hmm. So myself and I meet the Colombian girl down in Miami. We fly from Miami to Quito, Ecuador, with a U.S. Marshal as my security or surveillance team. Two other marshals as well. We get down into Quito, Ecuador, into the airport, and we're going through the airport being briefed by DEA, by the marshals, the surveillance team. We never actually met. We just kind of like got off the plane, and then here you guys are. We're getting you through the airport, getting you through customs and everything, and briefing mm-hmm. you at the same time as what's going to transpire. So remember the, I don't know, it was DEA agent that said it, or with the marshals, but anyhow, it was briefed to me that, hey, listen, when you get outside, there's going to be an Ecuadorian national police officer, tall guy, black hair, wearing a red polo shirt, black pants. He'll be standing next to a taxi. He's one of our guys. Spot him and jump in the car, and he's going to take you to the hotel. So she's hanging on to my arm, and we're walking out and everything. There, it was one of these small airports. Going back to like in the, the 50s, 60s. Uh-huh. We got these small airports, and everybody's come out of the airport, and you got the chain link fence there, and they're just 6, 7, 10 people deep for the yep. entire length of the airport. And so it happens. He was there. He saw both of us, but couldn't get our attention. So we bebopped down along the airport there, and we spot the guy. So we jump in the car. Well, it turns out that the EMP car and driver they were going to use for the undercover to carry us broke down on the way there. So this just happens to be Joe Schmo, a taxi driver, dressed with the same attire that everybody tells us what to look for, and we get in the car. So we find that out later. We don't know that at the time. So we get in the car, and we go to take off. So you got a picture it's like a 1962, 64 Studebaker. It's vinyl seats. It's vinyl floor. It's a stick on the column. I mean, it was just everything you could think. It was the bottom line of any car. And so he reaches up underneath the dashboard and takes two wires and starts the car. I'm like, what the hell is going on here? And this is supposed to be a police car, so I'm told. And we take off, and she knows what's going on. Like, they're going to keep me as a hostage. Like mm-hmm. I said, the whole plan of that. As we leave the airport, we start going up this little bit of an incline, and the car stalls. So the guy's trying to start the car, and won't start. In the meantime, my surveillance team that I knew I was within the airport, they all kind of made the traffic light on the highway and ready to go. And I'm sitting at the traffic light in this car that's not running anymore. Then all of a sudden, these three guys approach the car, and they're trying to push the car, but they can't push the car. It's just so heavy and going mm-hmm. uphill. So I opened the car door to get out, and she's pulled me back in the car like, you want me to leave, because she knows that what's going to happen is if these are the bad guys, they're going to take me. I don't have any plans for the plane. First of all, and second of all, I'm a DA agent. So you know what that's a DA agent's life is like down there in Colombia, Ecuador. Yep. So I get out of the car eventually and start pushing the car. So now I've got four of us pushing the car. We jump start the car, off we go again. I jump back in the car and boom, we're running, going down the highway. Everything's going good. We're like in, seems like we're in the mountains. So if you remember, that movie, Clear and Present Danger?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, we're going to get to that in a second. So we're driving like through the mountains in Quito, trying to come down out of, you know, from the airport or whatever. Either so, maybe it's on the other side of the mountain, but we're in the mountains and I'm looking down. It's starting to get dark and all of a sudden, the car stalls out again. Like, what the hell? We're on this highway. There's no cars coming either direction. My surveillance team is completely gone. So it's just me and her and the driver. So we're waiting there. And it seemed like about 5-10 minutes. And all of a sudden, this car pulls up behind us. SUV, there's two guys in it. And I'm like, this can't be good. So like, there's nobody here. I didn't even recognize these guys before their car or anything. So it turns out that they were ENP, Ecuadorian National Police, calls into the captain. Captain comes back in a marked unit now. He's in uniform, in a marked unit, pulls up, takes our bags out of the trunk of the car, throws them in his car, takes us out of the car, puts them in the back of his car, and now we're driving down the highway again. Now we're undercover, and we're in the back of a marked police car. Driving back down. We get down into the town of Quito, and he flags down another taxi cab, gives them directions to the hotel, and says, here, you got to help these people out, kind of thing. And so we go out of the police car into a taxi cab, and off we go again. And now we're driving down through these little tiny streets, kind of like in the movie Clear and Present Danger, where you can't open the car doors. You're driving down these little tiny alleyways. Yep. If you stop, you got to make sure, if you're going to open the car door, that you're lined up with the house there, because otherwise you can't open the car door and you can't get out. So you're going to get out of the car and get right into the house. She's in a panic. She's like, Sam, what are we going to do? I said, I don't know, but because I can't carry a gun. I'm unarmed. And they said, just whatever happens, happens. We're just going to have to run for it and keep running until you find some kind of an embassy. Wherever one it is, I don't care. Just go to any embassy and we'll knock on the door and make our way inside. But we have to jump the fence or whatever. But we're getting inside an embassy. So that was our kind of our game plan. And kind of is the only thing we had, the only thing we could do. We didn't, like I said, yeah. I wasn't armed and in a foreign country. I didn't speak Spanish. That was the only thing we had left. It was to get out and run. And we finally make it up to the hotel. Pull up into the hotel and it's a U-shaped driveway. We pull up inside the hotel and grab the bags. We walk inside and there's my entire surveillance team. DEA, the marshal, everybody sitting around in the lobby there waiting for us to arrive. I said, where have you guys been for the last hour? I've been running around by myself. So we check in and everything's going well. And again, she's totally in a panic mode. She is like hanging on to me like she was my girlfriend.
Mm-hmm.
So we check in and we go upstairs and drop my bag with my room and set up your room's right down the hallway here. And she's like, no. So I'm staying with you. So walk down to her room and we put our bags in there and we go back to my room and Marshall's call and say, hey, meet us up on the next floor up. We're going to brief things out and see where we're at. So we got these phone calls are being made from room to room to room and whatnot. So we get a game plan and everything together for the next day. Then, we go to bed. We, you know, just tired. We get ready to go to bed. I got an EMP officer sitting at the foot of my bed with a gun and I'm trying to go to sleep. Yeah, you know, some stranger. I don't know who the guy is, but he's with the MP, and he's at the foot of my bed. So this is not working out very well. Oh, so then, kind of doze off a little bit, and then all of a sudden, we get a knock on the door. It's the security from the hotel. They come in, and they still don't understand how this took place, but they were in charge, and the MP had they just had to comply with whatever the security guys wanted. So they were getting ready to get us all out of the hotel. You know, the surveillance team were in different rooms, and because we were making phone calls, going from room to room, they all thought we were drug dealers. So the security of the hotel raids our room, takes our passports, takes our IDs and everything, and get ready to kick us out. Then a bunch of phone calls are made. We finally get it straightened out. Finally go back to sleep. Next day, we get up. We're supposed to meet the bad guy. No calls, nothing. Nothing comes through. It's like, oh, you know, well, I guess he... we guess we blew everything yesterday between going from car to car to car and spotted us and now we're having a march unit and it's just, I guess we just thought everything was all blown. Mm-hmm. So we don't hear from them. Next day we make a phone call And he answers and says, no, I seen you guys at the airport, described me, described my stepmother and everything, right to a T, the clothes we were wearing and everything. So he was definitely at the airport and seen us. And he just said, I just got tied up on another meeting, couldn't attend to meet with you guys yesterday. He says, we'll meet tomorrow. I said, all right. So that was our game plan. We're going to meet tomorrow.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Sitting around, nothing's happening. All of a sudden, we get a phone call from the lobby. Come meet me, I'm downstairs. Well, I've never seen so many guys scatter.
Sneaky.
So I went down, got in the lobby, got all situated, and then she and I could walk down, meet the guy, and they pounce on him. It was like a kidnapping. They threw a bag over his head, ran him out the front door. We took off running the other way because we don't know if he's with anybody. So we run back upstairs. We're hiding out, and then the marshals come back and knock on the door, and they said, you wouldn't believe it. We got the guy. He was on the U.S. Marshals top 15 fugitive list back in 1991.
Wow.
And we caught him. Marshall said it was crazy. He says they went outside and they had two EMP cars coming up, one behind the other. Guys hanging outside the cars with Uzis. And they just rolled up. He said they took a bag over the guy. They ran him out the front door, opened up the side door, the car, threw him in the car and took off. It was like a kidnapping. Off they went. Wow. So we were all slapping high five. We caught the guy. So then they said, you guys want to go see where he's at? Sure. So you ever see that show back in the 60s, that show Get Smart? Remember the goofy agent? They used to walk through door after door after door, and then doors would slam, this acting thing. Well, that was what this prison was like, except that it was like 12-inch thick oak, solid oak doors. And behind it, you had iron bars. And then behind that, you had another door and another door. I never been through so many doors. I mean, I've been through a lot of federal prisons, but I've never been so many doors as I went through at this place to get to this guy. When you got to his cell, there were three guys sitting there with Uzis. You were not getting to this guy no matter how you looked at it.
Jeez.
So we go out to dinner. It was like, I guess, about 10, 15 of us, Ecuadorian National Police, marshals, myself, I think DEA agents. And, we're all happy, excited we got this guy. So the next day, we were supposed to pick him up and take him on a plane and bring him back. And for some reason, there was something kind of delay or something that happened. So we went sightseeing. So we went up to the Ecuador National Police, to our police academy, and got a tour and everything like that, and hung out. And then I flew home. I think this was the next day I flew home. And then when I get home, the marshal was telling me, he says, man, did you hear what happened? I said, no. So we almost lost him. I said, we mean you lost him. He was in the freaking cell. You guys all around him. I said, how could you lose him? He goes, there's something with maybe I don't know, because I didn't work overseas, but international law says something about if you arrest somebody from one country, you notify them through the embassy about, something. I just say there was some kind of agreement between Ecuador and Colombia, where they had some kind of an agreement where we arrest one of our citizens, we notify us. Well, they notified them, and the Colombian government was en route to the prison to pick them up. As the marshals were taking them out, the Velez out the back door, putting them on a plane and flying them back to the countries. We almost lost them and caused an international incident between the United States, Colombia, and Ecuador.
Oh, my God.
This all takes place with me being less than 6 months on the job and before the Laikiki case.
And you're thinking, what have I got myself into? But, man, this is a lot of fun.
This just all happens in May, so it's Mother's Day, and I'm out of country with my wife at home with the first newborn.
Yeah. Yeah.
Happy Mother's Day.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
So, and then that led into the Laikiki case. And then that was.
That was in May. Then again, September is when the Laikiki case comes along. And so I had quite a good career, I could say, up in New York. And
how long were you in New York?
5 years.
So. And then did you ask for a transfer or did they transfer you out?
Basically, until you came to me and said, you can go anywhere you want.
Nice.
So, you know, you've done your tour of duty here in New York, and if you want to stay, fine, but you want to go somewhere, you write your own mm-hmm. ticket. Well, at the time, I was traveling back and forth 85, 90 miles from home to the office, and it was starting to put a little bit of wear and tear on me, my family, and I said, well, Camden has some openings coming up. It says, I'll take the Camden office. It's in my backyard, kind of, so to speak. And so I transferred to the Camden office.
If I remember correctly, you spent a lot of nights sleeping on the floor there in the DEA office in New York, didn't you?
How'd you know that? Did I tell you that? But you're right. Yeah. I had brought up my own cot, fold-out cot, and then I had some good supervisors. Yeah. My ASAC, Jack Toll, gave me the key to his office, and he had a sofa in there and said, here. You can come and go as you please. You know, if you get tired during the day, come here and take a nap. You know, if you want to stay overnight and sleep in here, says you got the key to the office. Go ahead and showers, or, you know, down at the gym downstairs. There's times that I just always had one or two, maybe even three sets of clothes, a bag in my car, my G car, and wherever I slept, I slept.
Yeah, that's the sacrifice that guys and girls are willing to make to do the job.
Yeah.
That's what I tell you what, man. And I know that happens with other agencies, but in my opinion, that's what makes DEA very special.
Yeah.
Because our people are willing to do what it takes to get the job done. Whew. So now Camden, if I remember correctly, Camden was one of the most dangerous places in the United States, isn't it?
Or yes, wasn't it? I think it still is. yeah, it's bad there.
So you're like jumping out of the frying pan into the fire here.
Yeah. But it's closer to home. So, I mean, it was. Yeah. That made a lot of difference when you take 3-4 hours of your day on the road.
Yeah.
You're not driving. But,
and you're missing everything with your family. I mean, you're not there for birthdays or anything. So when you get to Camden now, are you're still an agent in another enforcement group?
Yeah, there was only one group. So in Camden and just working cases.
How many agents did you have in Camden?
I think there was... three when I got there, and I made the fourth, and I think they were bringing in two more, so they were expanding the office to, I think, from, you know, three agents up to six, and then the office has grown since then. Even
did you guys have a task force?
There was a task force. I think there was 4 or 5 task force officers that were assigned.
So you pretty much got to work a case like it was when I went to Greensboro. You got to work with your state and local counterparts.
Correct. Yep.
And the fact that you used to be with the prosecutor's office there didn't hurt anything, did it?
Oh, no. No, I had great relationships with the state, the prosecutor's office, and then the local officers I knew before I even came on the job. So
I think I read in your bio that you helped create one of the tactical units. Was that in Camden?
It was. There was myself and several of the agents, both out of Atlantic City and Camden, that we were doing a lot of the, I put it this way, we saw a need for a tactical unit, that mm-hmm. we were doing a lot of high risk or slightly high risk entries, and we just needed to be better trained. And we presented that kind of information to management, and they went along with it. It was a good thing. It's actually one of the best things DEA's ever done.
In Camden, was your SAC in Newark?
He was out of Newark, right? Yeah.
Yeah. So they went, but they went along with that. And I think that they eventually came up with a whole lot of those teams, didn't they?
They did. And that was based, I think it was based off of the, was it
the MET program?
No. It wasn't the MET program. What's the program that they use the agents overseas?
Snowcap.
No, there's another one.
FAST?
FAST team.
So this was later on.
So FAST team was already in place. And we kind of mirrored that and showed them that, yeah, this is the need that we have here in New Jersey. And they said, well, you know, go for it and we'll back you up on it. Just don't let it be your only duties. In other words, mm-hmm. don't just sit there and not have to make cases or do other work as an agent. But now that could be one of your auxiliary performances. That was created. And then DEA, along the lines of that, created the DEA program. So they saw a need for that, both for agents overseas, and then we put that in for the SRT, Special Response Team, because we were starting to do a little bit of security for, I think the administrator came in to into Jersey and into Philly a couple of times, and we were tasked to provide security for them to help out with the security team out of DC, which all led, just one thing led to the next, and it's definitely a good program that DEA did. And now I understand that it's even going way beyond on the capacity that we had it. Now they have Bearcats and they have response vehicles, and they've taken it to a whole new level than where we were at.
Yeah, it was when I was a brand new supervisor, I was in HIDA for a year, and then I took over the MET team, for mobile enforcement team, for the Atlanta Field Division for a couple years. And when we were down, I was trying to get all the extra training we could, because we were averaging at least one shooting a year back during that, because you weren't going for the big drug traffickers. You're going for the most violent in these small communities. And we got a lot of support. Frankie Schroeder was in charge of the MET program up in headquarters at the time, and he supported me 100%. But I think that was kind of the beginning, where we were trying to create these, I mean, for lack of a better term, our own war wagons through a Suburban or whatever it might be, or a van.
Well, that's how we started out. We started out with just G cars. And then once we just got this program up and running, we got our hands on a cargo van, and we outfitted that. And then when I left, it took it even to another whole level. And like I said, they got Bearcats now, and they're, not say a SWAT team, but they're not far behind.
Right.
With the training they got going on now.
And you were, one thing I saw about you that kind of surprised me, you were a tactical medic.
Right.
So you were in the, you were an EMT already prior to DEA, right?
I was, but I let that expire, where I just stopped doing that. And then when the DEA program came along for an EMT, I requested to go back into an EMT position and did that. And that's what kind of rolled me over into a DEA medical.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Did DEA put you through the tactical medical training?
Yes, they did. Yep. Yeah, that was a great course.
That's something that should have been done long before then. Yeah,
absolutely. But it's just, you know, hindsight, you can't look back on it. But the way things progressed and the way management and DEA is fulfilling the needs of the agency, it's a good move.
Did you take any promotions in DEA?
No. I was a street agent all along.
And did you finish up in Camden?
I did.
When did you retire?
December 2015.
Okay. And why did you decide to retire?
I had an opportunity to work in another capacity.
After being a fireman.
But anyway, it got to a point where, in all honesty, I wasn't carrying my weapon anymore, to be honest. The last several months, it was just sometimes I'd leave it at home. Sometimes I'd leave it in the office. And that's when I knew, hey, you're not doing any justice to yourself. You're not doing any justice to the team. You're not doing any help to the DEA. It's maybe time is for you to go. And that's when I started thinking about it. And I said, well, I need to pull the plug.
Would you think you were burnt out? Or?
I would say probably that was the case. Yeah. It got to the point where I just didn't like carrying a weapon anymore. And that's when they say, well, when are you going to retire? When are you going to retire? Well, you'll know when it's time. I could have worked another 2 years to be forced out. I was 55 when I left, and it's mandatory is 57. Could have done another two. But I just didn't want to put the onuses on DEA, my teammates, my fellow agents.
Right.
It's not fair to them because my mind's not in. And I think I just was probably just burned out, and it's time to go.
Yeah. That's the best thing to do. And there's no dishonor in that.
Thank you.
None whatsoever. You did a total of what? 30 years in law enforcement.
30 years in law enforcement. Altogether.
That's enough. Especially some of the things that you did. Cause I know Camden is so dangerous, and you talked about going up to Trenton and doing things there. And that's just as dangerous.
Right. Jersey had two of the top 20 or top 15 worst cities in the country. And it was in our backyard, both Camden and Trenton.
And then you're just a hop, skip, and a jump from Philly, right?
Right.
That's an active place in itself. So you leave DEA, and just tell us what all you've been involved with since leaving DEA, because you've had a variety of positions, and you're still working.
Still working. Went on and became the fire chief for a local department. I did that for a period of 4 years. Then went back to just being an EMT for another year and a half. And then took on another job, a company out of Virginia, and was hired by them to do emergency management. So their company was contracted by the state of New Jersey. State police were in charge, but basically I worked for state police in the capacity of emergency management, trying to help towns and counties recover from natural disasters.
And that's what you're doing now?
That's what I'm doing now.
When you became fire chief, did you have to go to a fire academy?
Oh, I went to the fire academy, several courses throughout my course of my career. I spent over 40 years in the fire service.
Now, and I'm looking at you, the title here, you're a public assistance coordinator for the Continuity Operations Group.
Correct.
What does that mean? Let's say a nor'easter blows into Jersey or hurricane, whatever.
Yeah, once a disaster is declared by the president, and then the local towns, municipalities, state and local governments, profit, nonprofit organizations, all those who qualify under FEMA, they start doing their work, doing repairs and trying to recover from the disaster. So hurricanes, tornadoes, straight line winds, floods, all that kind of stuff. I help them get their documents together, plans to get recover for reimbursements from FEMA. So it's kind of like a liaison position between FEMA and the applicants.
So I got to ask you, is FEMA that big a nightmare as we always hear on the news? Or you got no comment?
I have no comment.
Okay.
Now, I tell you what, and the people that I worked with FEMA, they've been great. They really have. They're very caring people. They're there to help. I know everybody says it. Oh, here comes the federal government. They're here to help.
Yeah.
Their hands are tied, just like, you know, in law enforcement, hands are tied with certain things. You can only do what the law permits you to do. Mm-hmm. And the public doesn't understand how the funding works, what requirements that you have to have in order to get that kind of funding. There's all kinds of regulations, and it's not their regulations. It's mandated by Congress. It's mandated by federal law, policies that you have to go by, and there's a lot to it. So, yes, I understand today FEMA is in an uproar. They don't know which way they're going, but hopefully the president gets things worked out with FEMA and Congress and everything and gets things back on track. But you know, I'd like to shout out to our first responders down in Texas and Carolina and Arkansas. Prayers to all you guys.
Yeah, big time.
They got their hands full.
Yeah, and there's some support groups, I think some nonprofits that get involved in those. I've got a couple friends in one called Aerial Recovery. They respond. They don't ask for anything. They just want to help. A lot of those guys are former military operators. I mean, some studs and studettes involved with that. So good people. Just want to mention some of the recognition you've gotten throughout your career. You were awarded the DEA Administrator's Award, which for us is the highest award we could get within DEA. I don't know if it's still like that, but it was back in the time. Department of Justice awarded you the Asset Forfeiture Exemplary Service Award. What case was that associated with?
So the asset, that was the asset forfeiture one you're talking about?
Yeah.
Yes. We started a program as a result of a case that I worked with a partner, a local detective. And it was an undercover operation altogether, but we wound up sending out vehicles that had traps in them. And we recovered a lot of drugs, a lot of money. I put on training for K-9 units, state police K-9 units, and a lot of the funding or a lot of the assets that were seized were a result of that operation. So that's what led to.
Very cool. You got the Attorney General's Exceptional Service Award. Was that for the Laquica case?
The Laquica case. Yep.
You got the New York Federal Employee of the Year Award. I've never even heard of that one.
Me either, but yep.
But you got it.
Got it.
The Federal Drug Agents Foundation American Hero Award. Was that Laquica also?
No, that one was the meth case that we wound up taking all the way back, following from Jersey to California, from California to Tijuana, leading back to the Arellano.
Felix Arellano. Right. Yeah. And then the Camden County Prosecutor's Office Narcotic Unit Citation. Is that before DEA? Or?
No, before DEA.
Yeah, those are some pretty significant awards to get in your career, man. That's very admirable.
Thank you.
You've done a good job. And you've been a good friend. You've stayed in. I'm the world's worst friend. My wife will tell you that. You already know that. I'm terrible about staying in touch with people.
Yeah, but you're busy. Still, you know? Yeah, you're busy. You got this podcast going. You got different events here presenting.
I have to take care of Javier. That's a full-time job.
I was going
to
say that's a full-time job. Oh, Javier.
Yeah. But it still baffles my wife because we can go years without talking to each other. And then we get back on the phone or a Zoom or whatever, or see each other in person. And it's just like we were together last week. She's
exactly.
Like, what is wrong with you guys? How do you do that? I was a cop when she married me. When I first met her, I was a city cop back then. And I mean, she's never known me to do anything else. But just before we go here, Sam, one question I like to ask all our guests, especially people that I have the utmost respect for, and you fall in that category, is what words of wisdom would you have to offer anyone that's maybe considering a career in law enforcement? Anything that you'd just like to leave us with here before we sign off?
Good question. Never gave that much of a thought. I would say that if it's in your heart, then it's in your dreams, then give it 100%. Do it safely, but don't do it half-ass, and don't just do the job just because it requires you. Make sure you do it 100% correct in your parameters, and stay above board. It's a dirty world out there.
Don't tarnish the badge.
That's it.
I love it. Everybody, I looked on social media. The only place I could find you was on LinkedIn. Is that right?
Not necessarily, but yeah, I have a Facebook page. I don't post too much that kind of stuff. I'm more or less, even with the LinkedIn, I just go on and read what people have to say. And yeah, sometimes I like what they say, and other times I just laugh and carry on.
And some of you look at it and you think, what an idiot.
Exactly. But I'm not one for posting a lot of stuff. But I do have a Facebook page.
All right. I mean, if you guys want to find out more about Sam, you can at least check him out on LinkedIn. It's at Sam Trotman, Trotman. Brother, I can't thank you enough for giving me your time here. Sam was wondering today, what in the world are we going to talk about for 2 hours?
It's coming up on 2 hours, right?
That's amazing. For me, these conversations go by. It seems like we just sit down. The only thing that gives me an indication I've been sitting here for a while is my right hip starts hurting. Part of this old man thing. That's why I keep moving around in my chair because my hip's hurting. But it's been a true honor to have you on here, brother. Thank you for telling us the stories. I mean, a lot of people have heard about Danny Munoz Mosquera and the bombing of the Avianca plane, but here's the man that put the guy in prison. It took him years to do it, and he did it successfully. Took one of the worst, most dangerous people in the world off the streets. And unfortunately, he was on the streets of America when he was arrested.
Well,
that's scary, right there.
I appreciate the kind comments, but there's a lot that can be said. I mean, a lot of thanks owed to a lot of people, yourself included, Javier, the other agents that were in Colombia, the agents that I worked with in New York, supervisors, people in D.C. I mean, it was a team effort because when I went down to Colombia, a lot of the TDY, so the temporary duty personnel, were canceled. So a lot of people had to get down to Colombia for their own cases. And I know back in the day when I went, I was told by the embassy that, hey, you're here, but nobody else is coming. And so, again, it comes back to a lot of effort can be distributed out, and accolades can be distributed out to a lot of people, the supervisors in Colombia, and I think yourself and Javier. And I know there's several others, Claudia, and I can't remember the other guy's name.
Gary Sheridan?
No, it wasn't Gary. No, Gary, but there's another one at the end, like blondish hair. I think he had a mustache back then.
I can't think of it. Not Mark Strang, was it?
No. It comes back to the efforts were shared by a lot of people. And the backing of the supervisors, both in Columbia and New York, D.C., that were able to put this all together. And it goes back to the U.S. Attorney's Office, their cooperation, Department of Justice getting approval to indict cases that we did. Good thing.
It's all about teamwork, right?
That's correct.
Yep. So, ladies and gentlemen, you're looking at a true American hero sitting right there. You'll never hear him say that. He's a very true patriot who has served his country proudly for over 30 years and continues to serve in a local capacity. Again, I've already said this a couple of times. A real honor to have you on here, Sam. Thank you so much for giving us your time.
My pleasure.
And being open with your stories. And please give my regards to your family. We look forward to seeing you guys down here in Orlando next time you come down.
I'll be calling for sure.
And I'll take you someplace besides 7-Eleven. We'll go someplace better. They've got Wawa stations here. They have pretty good subs.
Well, you can always take me back to Columbia. We can go back to that restaurant up on the mountain.
Oh, remember that one? Yeah.
Oh, my God. I never had steak so good in my life. Damn, that thing was freaking good.
Yeah, just the name of it just went out of my brain here just because I'm old.
It was up at a little tiny restaurant up on the mountain there overlooking Bogota.
Candilejas?
Don't remember the name of it, but I tell you what, I ordered a steak, and the steak came out. It was about 2-3 inches thick. Yeah. It covered an entire plate. It was enough steak for an entire family of four.
Yeah.
And that just, it was no side pieces. It was just the steak. That was crazy.
Good stuff.
That was a good meal.
That's some of the perks of accepting the dangers that go along with the job, right?
Yeah.
All right, everybody. Listeners, thank you guys so much for continuing to come back. Thanks for listening to me and Sam do some catching up here, talking about some funny things, but also going through some serious events that I'm proud to bring to your attention, because these are things that nobody never knows, and people just don't know about it. It'll be in the news for maybe one day, and then it just goes away. But this is real life. These are the people that risk their lives to protect you and to protect me. So thank you for coming back. Just quickly, if you haven't gone over to YouTube yet, do me a favor and go over and type in Game of Crimes Podcast in the search bar. Hit the subscribe button. Check out some of the videos there. You get to meet all the people in person, not just listen to them, but you get to see them. Hit a like and send me some comments on that. I don't know why you keep coming back, but honestly, I really do, because you enjoy playing the biggest, the baddest, the most dangerous game of all, and that's the game of crime. Sam, thank you, brother. Listeners, God bless. Look forward to seeing y'all next week.
Take care, everybody.
Luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.